Hello, you are listening to Third Waves.
Third is a platform that amplifies underrepresented voices through print, events, and on the airwaves.
You're joined by me, Tribe, DJ, and radio hosts.
Me, Daniela, writer, musician, and producer.
And myself, Rona, stylist, founder, and editor-in-chief of Third.
This is a bonus episode to the Half East Asian BFF series.
If you're tuning in for the first time, we recommend checking out the other episodes too, but you can also just dive in here with us.
One of the episodes focused on Half East Asian media icons. And for this episode, we are bringing you one of them.
You guessed it. Keanu Reeves heard about our project and was like, count me in. Okay, it's not him, but we are so excited to present to you my new Half East Asian BFF. She doesn't know it, but she's definitely one of my BFFs now. Claire Eureka. Rona, can you tell us a little bit about who she is and why we wanted to get her on the show?
So Claire Eureka is a designer who many of you may know from the epic label Hanger Inc. Hanger Inc. brought you latex fashion in a luxury context. She also featured as a contestant in the Netflix series Next in Fashion. You may also know her for her work as a cosmic consultant working under the name High Priestess. She's Jamaican Chinese, so definitely a half East Asian BFF. And we can't wait to talk to her more about all of this.
So Claire, welcome to all my Half East Asian BFFs, a mini series from Third Waves. We're so thrilled to have you. I'm Daniela. I am half Danish, half Chinese, and I grew up in the UK and I produce this podcast with Rona.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Rona. I'm Nigerian British and also similarly grew up in London. Pronouns are she, her.
Well, wonderful. Thank you for having me anyway. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, we're so thrilled to have you here. Could you tell us a little bit about your heritage and identity to kick things off?
Okay, my heritage. So I am half Jamaican and half Japanese, born in London and raised for most of my life in London. Some of it was in the countryside here near Cambridge, where I am now. It's funny because there's so much heritage stuff happening right now. I literally just had a family reunion in Jamaica. And I've been planning with my mum. My mum is the Japanese one. Me and my mum have been planning our return to Japan imminently, maybe next year. That's the blend that's going on here.
Claire, I think I also read somewhere that you're ancestry kind of, even on your Jamaican side, haven't you got a bit of Chinese as well?
Oh, I do. Oh my God. Honestly, the Jamaican side, Lord. So on my maternal Jamaican side, my grandma was Maroon and Chinese, right? Her father was from Hong Kong. She actually never knew her father. So her mum was, do you know about the Maroons? The Maroon tribe are independent, you know, they're independent people in Jamaica, and they're made up of people native to those lands and combined with the people that escaped slavery, basically. So they're like the revolutionaries, right? The Maroons are always the revolutionaries wherever you find them, you know, like the ones in Haiti. So my grandmother's family are Maroons and they came from the mountains, right? So her mother decided to come down from the mountains and met obviously a sexy Chinese man in town. And that liaison gave her my grandmother, but because she came out and, you know, and had a baby by a foreigner, she wasn't ever allowed back into the Maroon society. She was basically exiled. But my grandmother was allowed to go back and stay with the Maroon community. So my grandmother never knew her dad. I can't remember how old she was, but she'd finally managed to get in contact with him. And went to meet up with him. But as she was on the way to meet with him, he died. can you deal with that? So she never met her dad. So that part I know nothing about. Obviously, nobody knows nothing about this guy, apart from the fact that he was from Hong Kong. And he was over there, I think, in the military. That's a big I think. I've got no idea. And then, yeah, on my granddad's side, I don't also really know that much. I know that we have a lot of West African Ghanaian descent that comes through his line and some, you know, some other stuff in the mix. It's just classic Jamaican. Who knows? It's a big stew. Things are happening. There are many things going on.
That is awesome that you know so much, though. Do you know what I mean? Like most people, I feel like I can trace back to, like, say, my grandmother. And even there, you know, I'm like, don't quite know that much. I know my grandmother. Do you know what I mean? That's amazing that you've, like, you found out a lot.
Thank you. I'm happy to have somebody say that to me, because it hasn't always been like that. You know, like I've spent so much time unlocking these little bits of information bit by bit, finding the people in my family. I've got one auntie who's got a good memory. So while she's around, I'm just like trying to eke out these bits of information. And then, you know, praise God, these reunions are happening and other stuff is coming through the work. So I used to feel like that, like, I don't know nothing apart from my grandparents. And now, you know, more is coming up to the surface of the great pot. So thank God.
That's really inspiring. I might have to take some notes from you, Claire.
Thank you.
I'm trying to work out the maths, but I feel like that makes you like 5/8 East Asian or something.
Okay. So, oh, good Lord. Yeah. Because there's obviously half from my mum, right? And then if my dad was a quarter, then I'm 1/8 from him. So
yeah,
I think that you're exactly right there, 5/8.
That's why I was so silent during that whole deep conversation. I'm just like, 1/8, 2/8.
You're churning those numbers.
Proving a stereotype there. Knowing your immediate parents' heritage, if you're coming from a mixed background, it's already like, you know, it's already quite some work to try to synchronize these different type of influences and cultural references. And can't imagine, what it was like for your grandma to, like, that sounds really heartbreaking on the way to meet her dad for the first time. And then passing away.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it just wasn't meant to be. Some of these things, it's so tragic, but it's also so common. Especially in those generations, you know, it's like I literally have just been watching this DNA program with my mum that's on BBC. And it's like watching that actually makes me feel better, because, like, oh my God, all of you guys are also drenched in these secrets. Thank God it's not just like me and my weird family. Because, yeah, there's all of these people that don't know their direct parentage, which for me is really stressful. So I feel super lucky that at least I have that together, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to ask you a bit about, like, how do you relate to your East Asian heritage? Because that's kind of the anchor of this mini series. All of our guests had quite different experiences. Some grew up mostly in East Asia, some grew up like exclusively in the UK. And it was like quite an interesting exchange really of that. Like, I grew up in China and for all intents and purposes considered myself Chinese until like someone was like, oh, who's the foreign kid and who's come to school this year? And I'm like, who is it? Looking around and they were like, all the faces are pointed at me. I'm like, oh, that's me.
Oh, it's me.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'd love to hear like how was your connections and those influences from your side.
Okay, so I would say growing up, I don't feel like I had a huge connection to my East Asian heritage, you know? In fact, I would say the opposite. I felt very detached from it. My mum never taught me her native language. So first of all, there's that, you know. And then secondly, my Japanese family is in Japan. Do you know what I mean? Like, I grew up in London, so my Jamaican family is in and around London / the States. So I was always very attached to my Black side, because this is the family that I have. You know, the Japanese side of my family I knew of, but I just hardly ever saw, because they're on the other side of the world. You mean, like, it's expensive to get there, it's far, and I don't speak the language. So it's like there's a few hurdles that you've got to jump over to kind of make a connect. You know, when I was growing up, we actually grew up in a kind of, it's technically a church, but it's a cult slash a pyramid scheme. You know, all religions are cults. Some of them are just more popular than others, but this one is legit a cult. So in this cult that I grew up in, there's a big mix of people from the UK and specifically from Asia. So I would grow up around a lot of Asian kids. And so I was comfortable with Asian people. I always felt a little bit lacking because, you know, with my other friends who might be Japanese, we had so much in common. We both had, you know, Hello Kitty pencil cases and stationery, you know. But they knew how to speak Japanese and I didn't. I always felt like a little bit of, you know, in the technical sense of this word, retardation in my development, in my Asianness, because I was, you know, I was lacking in this thing that I couldn't really control, you know. So I always felt like I was kind of lacking in that sense, because my only, you know, my only connection was my mum. And my mum also is kind of one of those people who basically legged it from Japan and never really wanted to go back. She's the black sheep of her family. So being the child of a black sheep, it's not easy. There were big bridges and they've been burnt before you were born ages ago. So, you know, it's a bit of a tricky one there. I feel like I've spent a lot of my life and through my work and in my mind, reconnecting these things, figuring out, learning stuff, even with, like, you know, a lot of my interests, you know, cooking, food, cinema, right, textile, all of these things that are just, you feel connected to in your spirit, right, through your taste, through your body. That's kind of tends to be the way that I've been able to build that connection, because I haven't been able to go back there that much, you know.
It's really interesting what you said about language forming a feeling of disconnect, as like, it's definitely something I've also experienced when I've been in Nigeria as a British Nigerian person. Yeah. It's like, would be amazing if you could actually speak the language and you could connect to people in the conversations they're having, as opposed to needing a translation. So I can completely relate to that. But you also just spoke about your work, and obviously you were the creative director of Hanger Inc.
Yes.
Brand founded in 2013, I believe.
Yes, correct.
You know, for at least 8 years or so was leading the way when it came to latex and rubber materials in a sort of high fashion space.
Yes. Thank you.
But I think your brand was also inspired by elements of your cultural heritage, or maybe your rediscovery of it.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. That's a lovely way to introduce and talk about my brand.
Well deserved.
Thanks. Like, it's kind of like an old baby, you know, that like everybody still remembers, like it was yesterday. So when I started that brand, it wasn't always a means for me to explore my heritage, actually. I kind of went into it, I was just doing stuff, you know. I was like, well, I'll just make this thing. Maybe it's that kind of like stumbling through the dark, you know. Like when I was in uni, they didn't really tell you anything about actually creating a brand, you know, which is really about your story. You know, I am the brand. What is my story? What is it that I wish to explore through the brand, and how do I wish to do that? So it took me a little while, I would say maybe like actually three years to have really kind of started to be able to manifest that through the label. Because I remember I was making these things And my best friend, who's still my best friend, and at the time was also running a label, I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do this next collection on? I'm so stressed and I've not got any cute ideas. One day she was just like, oh, I just saw this thing. It's actually on like Bozozoku Gangs. Look at that. And I was like, okay, here it is. She's Chinese. She's from Hong Kong, right? And we're sisters. So she basically gave me this. And this is what I was like, oh, okay. You know, when you start looking into something and it's like, that was the door that I walked through and then entered into this like conversation with Japanese culture that was not like a historical, you know, really ethereal thing. It was kind of like more recent things that I could connect with at that age. And that's when I started to actually bring, yeah, my cultural heritage into the design. You know, it's like I was learning about these different cultures, these different people who were very similar actually to me, but also very different. And that's when I started exploring that. And it wasn't on purpose. I was just like, oh my God, this excites me. So let me look at this. And since then, you know, I started doing this. I remember meeting with this press agent who was like, okay, look, you're finally putting your story in the GOMS and now they're making sense. I was like, well, praise God, it's finally happened. So, you know, once you start doing it, it's like something clicks because it's coming from you and it's also coming from a real excitement. That discovery is exciting and you can sense it in the clothes. Because there was a part of me that was able to be, you know, channeled through the garments and other people could then see it, you know. Before, yeah, I was making nice clothes, but it didn't have that excitement. It wasn't coming from my essence, do you know what I mean? Like everything when it was coming from that exploration was really coming. You could feel my essence in there.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me was in there, you know, and then that just like, it develops, you know, and I think in Hanger, I can say through that was really a lot of my exploration into my East Asian side was shown through that brand, right? Was shown through the films that we created, the garments, the fastenings, right? The ethos, but also the people that we collaborated with, you know, like my network and the talent involved also involved a lot of the people that I met on, you know, my travels over to Tokyo, the people that were also East Asian and Southeast Asian that were in London, you know, like it was kind of like Hanger became this Asian babe magnet, you know, it's that's just how it matured and it was wonderful. It was a great progression, actually, and you could never predict such a thing. It just happened like that, you know? It was pretty fab.
I think it's really funny when people almost connect to this essence, you know what I mean? They're drawn to something because of the essence of what is being created. And that definitely feels that's what happened in Hanger's story.
Yes.
I know when you sort of put pause on the brand, you were looking for a successor, so to speak.
Oh, yes.
But I don't think you found one, right?
It never happened. There were some people who had some propositions and they just weren't quite right, you know? Like, the thing is, I built this house and I didn't want to leave it empty, you know? I didn't want to just move out and just leave it to waste away because it was a sick house that I built there, you know, we did so many different things and it has so many capabilities that, you know, even I just popped up and sold some of the dead stock the other day. And it's like, that reminded me of all of the people that are into that brand. I'm not going to lie, are some incredible people, like all over the world. It's a crazy thing to have created something that has a life of its own. That is so powerful. You know, it's like giving birth to a really charismatic child. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, anybody want to look after this child? But also a lot of my friends were like, you can't give away, you can't sell this business because you are the business. It's yours. It's like saying someone want to adopt this, but the mum is still around. Like, makes no sense, mm-hmm. you know? And that's why it's kind of, it's still there. I even thought of relaunching it this year, but I'll tell you in a minute. There's another thing that I'm going to do instead. I want someone to buy this business. I've got new collections in mind for this business, but I just don't have the capability to bring it to life because there's other things that I am working on. So it's an interesting thing, isn't it? The successor never came because it's mine.
Yeah.
I just need someone to support it if it's going to still carry on living. Let's see. Throw it into the wind, see if it sticks anywhere.
That sounds exciting. Before, you mentioned as well that cinema and film was quite important for you when you were researching sort of like, or going more deeper into your Japanese heritage.
Yeah.
Or like inspirations for the collection. What sort of, who are your like half East Asian media or like icons within the media that you'd look towards if you had any?
Oh my God. That is a really hard question because I can't think of any. And I'm sure that there are some, but there's a funny thing that I think happens in the mixed East Asian culture, right? And I see this happen every day and it happens within me. It also happened a lot when I was on that Netflix show. When you're East Asian but white, you're in a very different group to East Asian but black. And the East Asian and black contingent doesn't exist. You know, it's like it's so small and it's not really represented. There would have, you know, there's people that are on the screen that I would have seen as kind of these like Western Asian representatives, you know, like the classic Lucy Liu, right?
Yeah.
These lot. I'm not in cahoots with these lot. These lot to me are, you know, like we're just not seen the same. It's, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Where, and the thing is, like, this is how I felt growing up. Now, as an adult, I feel differently because, first of all, my best friend of what, like 15, 16 years is Chinese. And so, like, my notion of Asianness is different. Right. But when I was growing up, I was like, no, but this is like white Asian and I'm black Asian. Right. And as a black Asian person, there's zero representation. The only person I could even name you now is Naomi Osaka. You know, who else? Who else?
Yeah, I was going to say Amore.
There we go.
Yeah, but it would, I know what you mean, because I think it would always be when someone was black Asian, you'd primarily associate them with being black, you know, just maybe just because of the color of their skin.
Yeah.
And then it would always be that fact you'd learn. It'd be like, oh, actually she's half Asian. And you'd be like, oh, cool. You know?
Oh, that's cute. But it's always the blackness, especially when you're from London. You know, and I think it's different. Well, I mean, I think it's different from the States. I'm not from there, so I don't really know. But I know that at least in the UK, if you're a bit brown, you're under the black umbrella. And so black, I mean, genetically is very dominant. Look at me, I'm dark and I'm looking so black. People with an eye can see that I'm Asian. And I'm actually, genetically, I'm majority Asian. You know, but it's not, race also, you know, is very much a social construct and socialized in the UK. The blackness is what you see first, you know? So you're right. Amory, I remember seeing her and be like, oh my God, is this someone who's like me? But even then, that was in like, you know, in my teens or whatever. So there really, there was not much to look at, you know.
Yeah, the inspiration for this mini series was that I had a bunch of friends who were all half East Asian, half white, just in my kind of climbing community, very randomly.
Ooh.
And we were having a dinner party, and everyone else was like out of the room, and there was just like the five of us left in the room, and we were just like, I've never been in a room where like everyone was half white, half East Asian, like such a specific mix.
Yes.
And it was like a really heartwarming and like kind of, yeah, a strange sensation. And it was like really lovely. And that's kind of why I was like, you know what, let's make a podcast series out of it. And yeah, I feel like a Black East Asian mix crew would have a very, like, we'll have like similar feelings, but like definitely we'll talk on so many different other points that didn't come up for us.
Yeah, it's just also because of the world, right? Because of our cultural migrations and connections, the Black Asian mix is just rarer. You know, it's just, that's just the way it is. White and East Asian is much more palatable, and it's just much more likely to happen. So I think it's also just a numbers game. Yeah, there's just less of us.
You know what? It's funny when I hear you say that, because that is a thought that also passed through my mind. I was like, oh, potentially there's just less people who are half Black and half Asian, right?
Yeah.
But then actually thinking about how, like, you know, Asian communities have gone to places like Brazil, and they've gone to places like Jamaica, mm-hmm. and they're in Africa right now. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Considering all of that, I feel like surely there must just be, you know what I mean? However, I do think it's racialization and the way that people are treated, because I think most people, you know, who maybe would have some aspect of Asia within their ancestry might not be like accepted or understood as Asian in the same way when they are Black.
You're absolutely right.
And I think also the representation problems as well, because we just came up with two names for half East Asian and Black people.
And also even like, you know, there's quite a few cute young R&B singers now that come under this bracket that are like, you know, they're like Janae Aiko type. And them lot. There's many, but even, you know, like your point is completely true, because I was thinking of this a while ago. You know, I only actually realized that my grandmother was half Chinese 2 years ago. My dad would always say, oh yeah, grandma was a part bit Chinese, a bit, so vague. Right. So I was like, okay, so somewhere back there. No, not like literally half. So you're right with this racialization, because my grandmother would never by anybody have been considered mixed race, first of all, or Asian. She's a Black Jamaican woman, full stop. You know, it's like, it's not, it has nothing to do with the, you know, her actual genetic makeup. It's just how you are seen as an, and racialized as, and she, there was just no lens in which she could have been seen in, you know, as someone who represented Asia in any way. You know, that's why I always get so interested when people are like, talk about how mixed race people must be seen as to be mixed race or biracial, whatever you want to say. But I think of my grandma, and nobody on this earth would have looked at my grandmother or dared to have said to her, yeah, but you're not Black. You're this. And it's like, I would like to see you try to say that to something to my grandmother. You know, it's like, it's so interesting, this whole concept.
Yeah. I think also because so much of that comes from belonging, right, as well.
Yeah.
And in the UK, we have very specific lenses through which we see race in.
Yes.
But actually, those have not always been the lenses which exist throughout the whole world.
Yeah.
And also, they haven't, you know, that they aren't even the lenses that exist now for some people, you know, because of how they understand belonging, you know?
Yeah, I think that you're right. And I don't know, it's interesting, just even this conversation is reminding me of, you know, my own ideas of, you know, actually there probably are more Black and Asian people than I even consider or think exist, because I'm just used to being the other and really being in the minority and that presence just completely just not existing, you know? And the only people that I really were meeting who were Asian were of a different type. But actually now thinking about it, it's like, maybe let's just shift this perspective a little bit, you know, because there is a little bit of evidence to the contrary. Thank you. Just learning every day, aren't we? My God.
Love it. Yeah, this is such an amazing conversation. I want to cover two fun questions as well and love to hear a bit about your upcoming project, because you said that you would tell us a bit about.
Oh, yes.
One of the things that we talked about with the other BFFs was food and sex. So our relationship to food, how we connect to our East Asian heritage through food, and also how that's influenced our sexual preference and dating life.
Yeah.
So take your pick of which one to start with. Love to hear. You mentioned you were talking about food previously already.
Yeah. Let's go with food, because I love food, like, first of all, right? But my entry into food came through my dad, right? The Jamaicans. My dad was the cook in the house, an impeccable cook, just like his mum. So I learned how to cook, but from a very Jamaican perspective, you know, with the season, the ancestors coming through with the season hands. So when it was, when it comes to like Asian food, actually, my mum is not a huge cook. Let's just say, leave it there. And neither is her family, right? They're not huge foodies. So when it came to connecting with my Asian culture through food, actually, it was my best friend and us spending time together, cooking together, that really allowed me to start to explore that, because she's an amazing cook, right? So she would be coming at me with this Chinese thing, and I'd be like, oh wow, okay, let me try and learn how to do this thing. So a lot of it would actually just be me improvising. And I kind of joke with one of my friends, she's half Jamaican, half Italian. She's basically a Michelin star chef. She's incredible. But we always talk about how when you get in the kitchen, ancestors are in the kitchen. Like, really, ancestors be in the kitchen. So when it comes to cooking and food, for me, it was like a thing of sourcing these different ingredients and listening to how I should be using them, you know, and really going with the feeling, okay, a little bit more, oh, a little bit more of that, and then a little bit more of this, a little bit, actually, just don't use that altogether, you know. And like, for me, it was like really about kind of actually listening to ancestors in the kitchen that made me good at making Japanese food. And the thing is, like, Japan and Jamaica have got some good crossovers when it comes to the curry. All I make is curry or noodles, or I make a curry noodle. That's basically it.
Amazing. Noodle is my favorite food, probably.
You know, so a lot of the exploration comes through there. I remember coming home one time and cooking my mom noodles, and she was like, oh my God, this is so Japanese. I was like, I know. It's delicious. Revel in it and enjoy.
Aww.
You know, because this is stuff that I learned outside of the home in my adult life. And then I brought it back, you know, to my home, to my mum. So it was an interesting way of doing it around the houses. You know, it didn't come from the house.
Yeah. I can tell that you're so into food, because you just became like 200% more animated when you're talking about food.
I know,
I'm here. Like, my hands, like, my head is on my chin. It's just like, oh, I want to hear more. I actually have a question for you, which is about like recipes, like passing down. I really enjoyed what you were saying about just like feeling the ancestry coming through. And it made me think that, like, in Chinese cooking, so I learned cooking from my mom, blah, 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 and like we laugh a lot about this, but in Chinese recipe and cooking, like, you don't put pretty much any measurements whatever. So no. It's just like two carrots, like, what size is it, or like some salt, Like even on TikTok and these like recipe videos, they don't give you measurements. Like put some salt, put some flour. And I was just going to...
Some. A bit. A bunch.
Exactly. And I was going to ask, like, is that similar with like Jamaican cuisine?
Exactly. I think like the anal way of measuring is kind of, it shows a lack of spirit. When you've got the seasoned hands, you're not saying, oh, exactly a level teaspoon of this. You dash it in. You know when it's too much and you know when it's too little, right? You're cooking with the spirit of flavor is within you. And that is not, it can't be measured. Do you know what I mean? And also it depends on the place. Like a lot of the flavor comes from your hands. And like, obviously I'm saying that in like, in how much you put in, but also in the heat from your hands, the flavor that comes literally from your skin. You know, it's like these things are not, they can't be measured. They're just, you know, it's an emotional, it's an energetic thing. You can't measure that.
I think there's a word for it in Korean. I wouldn't know what it was, but like when you make kimchi, I think like you're definitely not supposed to use gloves or anything because maybe some parts of it, but like, like that flavor coming from your hand.
Exactly.
It's like integral to the kimchi making process.
Do you know what I mean? Because that's your essence is then in the food because your hand has touched it. That's why, you know, if you've got the hand, you know it's going to be good. Your flavor is in there. And some people might get grossed out by that, but that's what makes it delicious is the hand that cooks it. You know, if I'm told to measure something, I've tried to follow a recipe a few times and every time I do it, it's three times. They were all awful. The food is disastrous. I can't even lie. Like, it's just disgusting. So I actually can't do that. If I could look at a recipe, I will look at the general vibe and the ingredients, and then I have to dash the recipe and just put in as much as I think is necessary. Otherwise, it tastes awful.
Yeah, what I've started to do now is like when I read recipes and let's say it says like 5 tablespoons of this and 1 teaspoon of this, I sort of like visualize it as like a ratio. So it's just like there's loads of this and there's a little bit of that. And then I'm like going to freestyle in between those numbers because not going to pick up a spoon for that. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Otherwise it messes you up and you end up with a flavorful dish like a white person made it.
Little wink.
flavorless. It's risky.
Oh, love it. So would you like to tell us about this upcoming project of yours that you just teased?
Yes. Let me tell you about it. Okay. So, right. As I explained earlier, the brand that I came up with, Hanger, was a real exploration of my East Asian heritage. And throughout that time, I was always thinking, when am I going to be able to bring my blackness really into my brand in a way that I feel honors it, you know, and is really feeling complete. And now I feel like I'm actually able to do that. So the past year I've been living between Gambia and the UK, right? Because also a lot of my roots are West African. So as soon as I went, I just went there. I thought I was going there for 2 weeks, ended up staying for 2 months, right? I landed there and I was like, oh, wow, this is like home. I've always lived here. Why would I leave? I spent a lot of time over there. And then actually since this year, I started making clothes again. Like I really felt the energy to start to create. And I started just creating. I've always wanted to create kimono, but I always thought I want to make kimono, but I can't make traditional kimono and I'm not even going to try. If I was going to do that, I would go and I would have to study. And what's the point? People are making it. I don't need to make it. You know, so what I started making was kimono, but in utilizing fabrics available in the West and in Africa. But then also combining that with my West African heritage and spiritual inheritance. So what I've really been looking at is, you know, for me, right, I I'm a very spiritual person. I mean, I don't know if you know, but I'm also a tarot reader and I do a lot of like healing work. So I think about a lot the power of the objects in our lives, the power of just everything that literally touches us. And so as a lover of clothes, I think about how can we spiritually elevate our life through our garments, not as something that is just like, oh, I'm wearing a cute top, but no, this, I'm wearing this top, like this red fabric I'm wearing today is because I just did this interview in which I need to be seen as a leader. And I'm an Aries rising, which means when I wear red, you see my authority, you know, and there's all of these little things like this that I think is missing from the way that we wear clothes, the intentionality behind how we choose what we're wearing. So I've been making this stuff. I've been exploring actually what are called Adinkra symbols, which come from the Akan people in Ghana, which is where a lot of my heritage is also from. So the things and the objects that I've been making now are a combination of these ancient symbols, which have deep lore behind each symbol. You know, there's deep meaning. Back in the day, and also still now, people would wear these symbols to tell stories on fabric. You know, the textile is the tapestry which will tell you a story and will tell the history of a people, will tell you what's going on in this event. You know, people would wear certain symbols if they're going to war or if they're going to a wedding ceremony, you know, and so on. So what I'm creating now is my own interpretation of, now I'm understanding these symbols. It's like the same that I did before, you know, with my East Asian heritage and with Hanga, is now I'm getting to explore my Ghanaian and West African heritage through now the learning of this new language, this language of symbols, right? And then putting them into a medium that I know very well, which is paint and fabric, you know, cloth, and then also ceramics. I also, you know, am a ceramicist, a painter and a sculptor. So what I'm doing now is really bringing these new learnings and these new languages onto things that I'm also exploring, you know, like creating the kimono shape, which is so simple, but so maximalist and minimalist at the same time, you know, and so iconic. And always I felt a little bit daunted by it, but now me reinterpreting it brings it into something that I actually feel is accessible for me, but also exciting. You know, I'm changing, I'm not trying to recreate something that already exists, because what's the point? I'm just reinterpreting. So the new label is, it's around this, it's this cross-pollination between West Africa, Japan, via London. I've also been looking at, I'm not sure if you saw, I posted a video the other day, my grandmother, my Obachan, she gave me some. She, her side of the family have been silk merchants for time. So she used to sell kimono silk. And last time I was there, 6 years ago, she gave me loads. And I've been hoarding it. My family are also hoarders. I've been hoarding it, kind of wary of cutting any of it up because I didn't really know. I wanted to really honor it. There's one thing that I made for my last girlfriend. I made her an amazing two-piece shirt and short set out of this kimono silk, which I'm not going to lie, is fantastic. She's so lucky and she knows it. But I finally realized what I'm going to make with this fabric also. So this is kind of like, I'm also bringing in these family heirlooms, you know, these silks that I've been gathering and just kind of like gently holding until their time to be, you know, made alive into something. And that time has finally come. So I'm also getting these vintage kimono fabrics and interpreting them into westernized garments. So everything that I'm doing is this kind of to and fro, you know, Japanese fabrics in a Western style in a Japanese, Western fabric in a Japanese style, but then with this African language on it, I feel very excited and also satisfied by being in this space with making clothes, because I really see now that all of these different elements of my being are able to come through in what I'm creating. Whereas before, you know, there were things that needed to come through that were coming through, but it wasn't, everything in my essence wasn't in there. But now with what I'm going to make moving forward, all of these elements finally get to collide in what I'm creating. And that's, I'm really excited by it. And I've only just started. And what I'm doing now is I'm just slowly making these bits and testing. You know, I'm putting them on people. I'm road testing them. And I'll, you know, I'll come out with some more, probably a little bit of a range, you know, in a little bit. But I don't want to make it like, you know, I'm going to do a 30-piece show and da-da-da-da-da. I can't be bothered with that. You know, I want to make some beautiful things. I want to put them on people. And I want to see how people feel. Do it bit by bit and do it like that. And I'll probably give it my own name. I'm probably going to call it Yuri. Let's see. It's maturing at a nice, light, and easy pace. You know?
That sounds so exciting. I can't wait to see.
Thank you.
It really feels like it's coming full circle as well. Like almost like another evolution from all the things that you've been doing.
Yeah, exactly that. It's exactly that. It's super exciting. Like even when I was in Gambia the other day, I ended up doing this dyeing workshop with indigo dye with this man called Musa, who also made the clothes and all of the textile for that film, Woman King. And I was like, it just so happened just before I left that this amazing hidden icon was running a workshop where I could dye one of the kimono that I just made with him. You know, it's like all of these things, everything just like comes through in such divine timing that it's quite spooky, but it's just perfect, you know, all of these elements just like fitting together in very beautiful ways.
I'm just getting this sensation, like hearing the story and the synchronicity, like the cosmic synchronicity of you meeting this dyeing master to dye your kimono. And I'm just thinking, like, this project could, I feel like, could for some people become like a vector for exploring and experiencing these two cultures, like people, your mixed East Asian, Black, West African crew.
Yes.
Yeah, it would be like very emotional, I think, coming across these garments for.
Yeah, I know, right? Like I'm really excited for just for people to find some connection through the pieces that I'm providing. You know, that's it. If they're like, find something new or just, you know, sometimes when it comes to stuff like symbols and dyes and smells and colors, these are things that are transcend our cultural conditioning or our cultural learning. You know, it's like symbols in life are, they're collective and they're part of the subconscious. Sometimes we see a symbol, we see a color, we taste something. It connects us on a level that we can't even comprehend. And what I'm hoping is that some of the things that I create are the vessel, you know, for some of these experiences.
Yeah, amazing. Wow, cool. Well, Claire, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've enjoyed this chat so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome, guys. Thank you for the great questions. Thank you for the cute chat. And thank you for asking me. It was really sweet.
It was so cool to chat to Claire. She's so wise. I'm really glad she's one of my BFFs now. So her Instagram, before I forget, is the Yuri Universe. That's spelled Y-U-R-I Universe. Obviously, we're going to link to her. Follow her because, I mean, I, for one, I'm so looking forward to getting some updates and news about her new project, which just looks, yeah, just sounds amazing. But yeah, I just want to say one thing real quick, which is like... when we started this journey, I was fascinated by the specificity of my group of like half East Asian, half white friends. Just like, it's just really unusual to have this group around me. And that was the starting point. But throughout the episode, I actually really enjoyed listening to you, Rona, and Tribe, like your comments at the end and how you resonated so much with the things that we were talking about, because you guys have sort of mixed cultural background as well. And so, yeah, that was just really interesting and felt like, yeah, we had like more in common, and it was just like really good to like specifically articulate that just from hearing you guys talk about it. And so the fact that like Claire is mixed Asian and Black kind of really neatly ties this together for us, I feel like, because yeah, as like kind of our cultural heritage is as hosts of Third Waves, which I just feel like it's like a really special, yeah, really special bonus to this series, really.
I love that analysis and the connectiveness of it. I was actually thinking about how awesome it was listening to Claire connected to Third and why we actually do, and actually one of the reasons why we're called Third. So obviously we're Third with three eyes, and one of those eyes is supposed to hark back to this whole idea of being third cultured, which basically explains the fact that, if you know, we all have a first culture which comes from our parents and their heritages, like our, you know, direct ancestry, a second culture that usually comes from the places that we grew up or the places that we're living, and the third culture, which is supposed to be like a mad blend of all these different things, like, you know, tumbling over each other. And I think in Claire's sort of stories, whether that be through her journey through cooking or her design work, or just through unpacking her ancestry full stop, we've really got a sense of, you know, being third cultured, which I just personally love.
I agree. It was like how those cultures kind of make and contribute to who she is. And even through like the discovery of her heritage as well, that she said she recently found out that she had Chinese, even in her Jamaican side, added to her own perception of herself. And that adds to her a kind of identity in the way that she sees herself, and then ultimately like reflect that out as a person. So definitely ties into the third and what we're trying to do here as well.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting how at the beginning when she was like, oh, I'm not that connected to my Asian side at all, and that was made sense what she was saying, but then obviously through her work and also this latest project that's going to be coming out hopefully sometime soon, you know, there's so much discovery. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, I feel like that was like a common thread that like also some of the stuff that Joe said in one of the episodes about like how it is that we come to connect or reconnect with parts of what, yeah, parts of our heritage, in some cases maybe a bit distant or hard to access, and or in some cases like how to keep something alive that you've been like separated from for a while. It's just interesting how people access that in different ways. And I think, yeah, accessing that through food and fashion is just, it's so magical.
And then I also like the to tie it back into the food, because why not? How she could also see those connections about the way food is, I guess, expressed as she was learning about her Asian kind of culture and food and the way that it's done, and tying it to her Jamaican side and seeing those overlaps as well. And so it kind of, I guess, solidifies, like she's taken bits that kind of makes her her and adding to it, but at the same time, seeing the overlaps in it and again, expressing it. It's nice.
And just as a reminder, we do want to hear from you. So if you have any thoughts you want to share with us about anything that Clara said or anything that you heard earlier on within the All My Half East Asian BFF series, you're not late. You can still send us a message. We want to hear from you.
We definitely do. I want all the BFFs in the world.
If you want to see some BTS, head to our TikTok where you can see what went down in the recording of this show.
You can also catch more from us on our website, thirdmagazine.co.uk. also with three eyes. If you're enjoying listening to us during this series, you might want to check out one of our earlier shows.
There are 20 episodes to listen back to, covering rich topics such as
dark tourism,
sex and relationships,
cultural appropriation
and cancel culture.
All of the music you've been hearing on this show is from our guest Reese's record label, Emperor Recordings. If you search them on Instagram, their logo has a dog in it. Follow them and go to their parties.